Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. Hi guys, let's have a meeting. Are we having someone tell our joke tonight?
Yes, Guy, did you get your joke?
Guy.
I'm an alcoholic, my name is Guy.
Hi, Guy.
Hi, Guy.
Group, sorry for the delay. I didn't know I was going to be at the podium tonight.
Me either.
But anyway, this is a rabbit walks into a bar. A newcomer was sitting in the back of the room before the meeting began and leafing frantically through the pages of the big book. An old-timer noticed her activity and asked, "What are you looking for?" "Loopholes," the newcomer replied.
Well worth it. My name is James, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Thank you for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation, so please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise that might or will distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. If everyone's ready, we're going to bring in the monks and dim the lights. Fog light prayer. If you don't know, it'll be up on the screen here, and there's yellow cards on the back of the chairs that you can read, follow along with. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me.
Amen.
There is a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked John to read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is. Please welcome up John.
John.
John, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
Yeah, that one. That's a spiritual experience.
It's
spiritual experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have the difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There's a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. That's Herbert Spencer. That's all.
Great job.
Thanks, John. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking and constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so turn your phone off and don't be on it. We have a guest speaker tonight, Joe Baer, who is a pillar in the South Florida community and has helped many men, and I'm excited to have him back here tonight, so please welcome up Joe.
Joe!
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
My name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic, and
hey,
I'm a member of the Ticket to Life group in Pompano Beach. On Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, if you ever get in the neighborhood and you're down for a meeting that evening, a big book study, and looks a lot like it always has, if you remember the Wednesday night study group. So we're just doing that on Tuesday night in a different name, and we hope to see you. I'm really grateful to be here tonight. It's good to see you, and my heart was singing on the way here. It's been a while, and a lot of good things have happened in my life. And, I'm going to try to convey that to you tonight. I used to live about, I don't know how many blocks, but Broward Boulevard is not too far from here, right?
Right.
2 blocks. I'm from a little town north, West Palm Beach. Used to be little. Not anymore. I was born and raised there. And come from a great family. 5 sisters, a brother, mother and father, that were incredible providers and caretakers for our family. Nurturing, guiding, and champions, leaders of life. And so I never have... That is not in my story to make any indication that I'm the result of them, because I'm not. I'm the result of selfishness and self-centeredness. That's me. And that happened a long time ago. Really early. When I was just coming out of the goo-goo gaga stage. You know, when I started to comprehend life. And so that was in 1956 when I was born. My sobriety date is 10/31/2014, and we're the only people on earth that get to live twice and die once.
That's right.
Imagine that. So I found myself on Broward Boulevard through a really messed up way of living and being and conducting myself, my attitude, my behaviors, my extreme selfishness and self-centeredness, that it got to the point where my family, through my addiction, I started drinking and drugging when I was 13 years old. And from that point, I found the very thing that quieted and gave me the relief I needed for my internal conflict, my internal struggle. I call it an internal condition, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But I found myself being dropped off on, I think it was Northwest 2nd Avenue, this was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was following probably about 30 days prior, because I had gone to treatment through a family intervention, and it was one of those interventions where you do this, or you leave town, you get out, we can't take it anymore. And this was over years of just incredible behavior, incarcerations, and all kinds of bad things. And I could be 2,000 miles away and be the dark topic of the conversation in my family. It was a very, you know, it was a very agonizing conversation. And I changed the lives of the people that loved me the most. I altered their lives in such a way where their friends and their work environments were beginning to be compromised because of somebody saying, hey, how's Joe doing? They just didn't even want to face it. They didn't want to have to respond to that because it was too painful for them. You know, our loved ones get sick. They get terribly sick and develop all kinds of new struggles within and burdens that were inflicted on them. And I always said, my people, by me. And like I said, I could be in the same house or 2,000 miles away, and I was still such a agonizing subject in my family. So when they had this intervention, and I had family scattered all over the country, and they were in my mom and dad's living room, because I was back with mom and dad again, like where I would always, that was my go-to coming out of the struggle, out of detox or whatever, after crash and burn, because I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't have any money. I was always broke, homeless, jobless. And it was a small place. And, you know, the living room was probably, I would say, 14 by 14, 14 by 15. And everybody in my family and extended family were in that living room that morning. And I came out of a terrific hangover, which I always had really bad hangovers. And I go in, and I knew that was Judgment Day. You know, my heart sank. I had no plan, never did. I just assumed I would be taken care of, coddled, and my absolute needs were met, like cigarettes, you know, cell phone, the immediate necessities of life. And they said, "Look, we're gonna do one last thing for you, and you're gonna go through treatment." And they all got together and they pooled money and sent me to a place called Palm Beach Institute in West Palm Beach. It wasn't cheap. It was very expensive. So that was a big financial burden on them. They said, so you go through this treatment center, and if this happens again, if you get drunk or high again, you're gone. I said, okay. You know, naturally, I took the parachute, right? There was still a tether there. There was still that little thing that where I could draw on their love and enablement and, you know, play that game over and over again. So I think I became such a con artist and an imposter. I didn't even know who I was. I had become my lie. I had become this selfish, self-centered predator where everything that I did and everything that I said was intended to have you have a conception of me that would be appealing or attractive, where I could lead you in, I could lure you in. You know, lure is something people fish with, and simply a lure is fake bait. And that's what I would do. I'd throw it out, and I would just send this fake bait out and hope they would take it. And they did for a long time, because I always couple that with all the things that I'm sure any parent, loving parent or loving sister and brother or family member would want to hear. Trust me, I'll never do it again. You got to believe me this time. Mom, I just got in a new halfway. I know I'm in the right place. Everything's going to be okay. By the way, can you send me $20? I was always leading with the story and always, and the hook was always coming. It was maniacal. I had become the person that was so far, that had to be so far from the individual that God created me to be. Where I went my selfish and self-centered way, where the world was and the material things were my God. Everything on planet Earth was but lowercase God to me. And I had to really perfect a line of BS in order to acquire it. And I noticed that when I did that, I started to suffer these things. I start, like we have an allergy to alcohol. Merriam-Webster says that an allergy is an abnormal reaction to a food, a beverage, or a substance. When that was explained to me while John was going through the doctor's opinion, I said, well, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, I was definitely having abnormal reactions. But then it goes on to let us know that the manifestation of alcohol on an alcoholic or a drug on an alcoholic, if your drugs are dry or they're wet, it's still the same issue when it comes to the allergic reaction. And Silkworth, when he describes this in the doctor's opinion, he talked about this thing being a phenomenon of craving. Well, he didn't have any way to prove it because there was no money for clinical trials. He probably saw over 45,000 of us and kind of gathered some perspectives and, saw some patterns that really made him go, you know what I mean? It's like, so this allergy, this allergic reaction, you may have an allergy to anything, right? But the manifestations of that allergy, the symptoms, don't happen if you don't ingest it or get near it. If you have an allergy to strawberries and you eat a strawberry and you get a red rash all over your body and you puff up, you have the allergy to strawberries. Now, you're not going to turn around and go to a store and eat strawberries the next day after finding that out. Unless you're really mad, right? Well, Silkworth knew what happened when we ingested alcohol because he'd send us out with high hopes, after getting us undrunk and undrugged through some treatment, detox. And he'd walk us to the front door and say, good luck. Silkworth knew the problem. He didn't have a solution, though, to the problem. So he'd send us out and say good luck until Bill Wilson came around for the third time or fourth time, whatever it was. And he says, I think something happens in the body of an alcoholic. It doesn't happen to normal people. I think that you guys suffer. But he called it a fact. He said, the fact is that when you ingest alcohol, you have this phenomenal craving for more alcohol. In other words, when we ingest it, not drink a drink, the first drink, not a whole drink. When we just ingest it, that something happens within our body where the body craves more alcohol. Now listen, they determined that to be factual and certified in the 1950s when they deemed us a disease by the insurance. All kinds of insurance and money and stuff came in where we could have these labs, and they were doing clinical testing and all these different things, trials and so forth, where they stopped saying it was a phenomenon. Phenomenon just means, I go to Merriam-Webster all the time. She states that it's an unexplainable occurrence, a phenomenon. Like, I don't know how to tell you it happens. I just know it does happen. And Silkworth was kind of using that word because he knew exactly what was happening. Because after he said good luck, we'd be back. Or we died. So he knew something happened between the time they left, when they were undrunk, and alcohol was, they were detoxed. And between that time and when they got back. And it didn't matter what we stood to lose. Didn't matter what we had acquired in life. Didn't matter what we had at home or our possessions or anything. We could stand to lose everything if we put another drink in our body. And we'd be back, shattered and broken in millions of pieces. waiting to die. So he knew something was going on. So he called this thing a phenomenon. And so he says that it happens, and it doesn't happen in normal. It doesn't happen in normal, temper drinkers or moderate drinkers or hard drinkers. It happens in alcoholics, where that when we put it in, and that the manifestation of that is that we can't stop. Now listen. It's now a physiological demand. It's an absolute proven fact that something within us, in our system, the way it works, they go into all kinds of science. And they just confirmed what he told us, that he was theorizing about. Right? So an allergy, if we have an allergy to alcohol or drugs, the manifestation of that is that we can't stop when we start. So when we start, all bets are off. And when we get stopped, something happens in our mind. So I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But the fact is that these manifestations or symptoms is that to an allergic reaction. I don't know if anybody in here has an allergic reaction to peanut oil or penicillin or anything like that. But those are more deadly. Well, listen, when I was coming up and I was starting to develop into this maniacal, selfish, self-centered individual, the things that I did, the lying, I was a habitual liar. I couldn't tell the truth. I had to lie about everything because I was always pretending to be something that I wasn't in order to get what I wanted from you that I thought I needed. So I had to portray that individual that I could kind of perceive you think I, or perceive that you, through a little bit of interaction, would want to what you'd like about somebody, right? Witty, charming, talkative, worldly, educated, financially stable. It didn't matter what it was, because you always could get your information from other people. They start telling you who they were, and it's like if they were somebody that like that, it's like, oh well, I'm somebody like that. It's time to kick in. I'd call on that little, who do I need to be? So doing that, being a habitual liar, you lose your sense of any kind of identity. You're always, from the time I woke up to the time I went to sleep, I was being calculated and extremely scriptive on how exactly or what I needed to do that day. Especially if you're an alcoholic or drug addict. I mean, listen, I needed to drink. It's not like I could, give it up for a minute. I had to have it. So everything that I did supported that, right? And it didn't matter about anything else. It didn't matter about becoming this liar and this cheat and thief and manipulator and deceiver, imposter. It didn't matter. But what happens is this. Here are the manifestations of that behavior and that way of being. Fear becomes paramount within. I'm scared of everything. What I'm scared about most is what you'll think of me or what you'll say about me or how you'll react to me. And you haven't said a word. You may be sitting 30 feet away and I never met you. But I knew you were thinking about me. I knew you were saying stuff about me. You know what I mean? I made it up. I was like, I had become this makeup artist. Like somebody could be, a man and woman could be walking down one side of the street on the sidewalk, and I could be going down the other side. And as our paths cross, they burst out into laughter. Well, what do you think I think? They're laughing about me. What are they laughing about? What do they think? What are they saying to each other? You say, I did it in meetings. I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 16 years. I was homeless right down there on Broward Boulevard. That's what happened after that drop-off at 2 a.m. in the morning after that intervention. They had it with me. They didn't hate me. They just couldn't. They couldn't survive their own lives healthily. I mean, they were. It was very unhealthy. And I was so demanding and entitled. I hurt them deeply. Well, I had become this guy with an internal condition of shame, of such shame, of what I did to my parents and my mom and my family. I became lonely, like bone crushing. The book says bone crushing loneliness that nobody else, that few others know. I became regretful, full of remorse and regret, full of embarrassment. I was embarrassed about myself. I was embarrassed of me. I felt like, I didn't know how to deal with that other than relieve the pain. A lot of people wonder, why do people go out today? I mean, they're sober, they're doing this and they're doing that. There's only one reason we go. It's because this hasn't been corrected and they're looking for relief. That's all I thought about. Silko says we become restless, irritable, discontent. When we're not drinking, even though we're an alcoholic, and like we start, we ingest it and we can't stop. And then when we're stopped, we can't stop starting. That's the key. If you can't stop when you start and you can't stop starting, you're going to die an active alcoholic. There's no other way out. Unless that conversation, that lie, that obsession lie, that John called it consulting with the idiot. He says, like, Joe, you're consulting with the idiot. You go like this. He says, one half of your brain's selling the other half a bunch of BS and the other half's buying it. Like, wow, you know what I mean? I think if I go get a bottle of liquor, that'd be a good idea. Yeah. It was the lie. It'll be different this time. Nobody will know. I'll just go out for a six-pack. Whatever I did to have this self-determined pre-objective of what I was going to do and how much I was going to drink, after the first one, it didn't matter. When I started, I wasn't drinking like to get to this place of comfort or witty or be a good communicator or any of that stuff. That was my truth. I need to relax, man. It's been a stressful day. You know, that was my truth. The truth, but it was a lie. The truth was I was drinking and using to overcome a craving I couldn't overcome. That's crazy. Listen, if you can't stop when you start, or even at best, you can't moderate or slow down, when we drink into oblivion, we pass out, crash and burn, and come to saying, I'll never do that again. Silkworth said, man, we have this resolve. We say, I'll never do that again. And about 2 hours later, John called it the law of diminishing return. What happens is the physical pain goes away. I'm starting to feel a little bit better physically. And then it, wah, 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 wah. God, it wasn't that bad. Wah, wah, wah. Yeah, you know what? You're right. I could have just gotten out of jail, being on 6 months probation. And if I go back, I'm going for life. God, it wasn't that bad. Nobody will know. And I would convince my, you know what, yeah, right, nobody will know. I'll just do a little today and I'll stop tonight. Nobody's ever said that before. I know I'm unique in this deal. And I convinced myself that this was a good idea. In spite of all the carnage, all the destruction, all the loss and prices of all the people that I hurt. What I stood to lose. For the foolish idea, it's not a foolish idea, it's a foolish lie. But I couldn't stop myself. You know why? Because I had to have relief. I could not be in my body with my reality and my past without being intoxicated. That I knew, and every alcoholic does, knows it, absolute certainty, that the only way to get relief is to have just one. What? He says we can't recall with sufficient force a memory of suffering and degradation and humiliation a day, a week, or a month prior. We are without defense. I couldn't keep myself stopped. I couldn't get myself to stay stopped. God knows I tried. I tried all the ideas that ever came into my mind. I had a playbook that was hardwired. I know what I need to do. Oh my God. Like towards the end, I'd say that to my family, and they go, how can you say that? Your mind can only produce what you've gotten and given us. Your experience It's like my past, everything that happened in my past. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm grateful for every part. I'm grateful for everything that I had to experience. But all of it, the jails, the institutions, the incarcerations, the hospitalizations, the health issues, the family consequences that I created for them, the lying and the cheating and the manipulating, all those things was nothing more than a snapshot of my mind. Everything emanates from thought. Everything. Every decision. Every act. So it's like I have this thought. It makes me feel so. So I have a thought. I get a feeling or an emotion based on whatever it is I'm thinking. Just doesn't come out of from my knee. Right? So I have these conversational thoughts. And it's only about the past. I can't have thoughts about something that's ever happened. I can't have thoughts about an experience of something that never happened. So all my thoughts are emanating from there. Right? And I get a feeling and emotion based on that thought. I take an action based on that emotion or feeling. And I get a result. So I think, I feel, I act, I get a result. My results were terrible. And everybody that I knew in this world would tell you that my actions were terrible. Silkworth said this. He said a lot of good things. So just let me finish along that line. So, you know, every action that I took and the result that I got had an ancestor. The thought had an ancestor. I mean, the action had an answer. It's called thought. So when Silkworth said, we go through this over and over and over, and unless you, Joe, can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of your recovery. It's like, nobody ever told me that. I heard John Williams doing a big book study. He became my sponsor for almost 20 years. Doing a big book study. At a meeting I would have never gone to in my life. I met a guy at the House of Hope after I think it was my second tour there. That's over on Barrow Boulevard. And we became friends, complete opposite. We hated each other at first. And one night he comes home after we had befriended one another and kind of, you know, hung out a little bit. He says, Joe, I just went to a meeting. It was awesome. He says, I think you'd find it really valuable. Now listen, nobody ever, ever asked me to be like, I could see what I was making up about that is that he wants me to go and be kind of a, you know, to scope it out and hear it out and give him my advice. Like, I would go there and I would be, you know, the person that's going to let him know whether I think it's a good thing to continue on or not. That's insane. Especially since I'd never been to a meeting like that. I said, well, okay, Owen, you know, I appreciate that. You know, it could really flowed my ego. Wow, this is pretty cool. I thought, he thinks I'd find it valuable. Huh, how do you know? I guess he was talking to some guy that I pretended to be. And the next thing out of my mouth, this is where I was parked. About it, about the recovery, how it works. But no, this is how my life worked. This is how my mind worked when it came to anything AA back in that day. Because I was really resistant to just not drinking, going to meetings. I could do that. You know, I could line up with that if I was mandated to. And every place I lived in that was called a halfway house, they told you had to go. So, like, it wasn't by circumstance. It was by mandate. And it was always, you know, I'd like the speaker meetings because I could be off in a far distant land thinking about a life I never had the whole time and never hear a word. So he says, yeah. I said, so a big book study? You got to be kidding me. He says, it's a big book study. I said, no way, man. I said, let me ask you a question. Do any women go there? That was like, you know, one of those things, a box that I needed to check. Because that's one of the reasons I only went. He says, yeah, women go there. I said, okay. We got past that first hurdle. And I said, all right, well, I think I'll go with you. You know, I mean, listen, let me let you know during the week and blah, blah, blah. So he was pretty persistent. And the Tuesday night before that Wednesday, it was a Wednesday night study group. And the Tuesday night before that, he says, Joe, he says, listen, you going to go to that big book study with me tomorrow? I've got a couple guys going. We got a ride. Blah, blah, blah. I said, okay. I relented. Okay. And we went. We got there probably 20 minutes early. Nobody there yet. Not a soul in the parking lot. I said, wow. I said, how many people usually come to this thing, Owen? In the parking lot. Oh, he says, probably about 120. I said, wow. We're really early. I said, well, I got to go to the bathroom. I said, where's the bathroom? So he said, over in this, it was like a parish hall, like a cafeteria style thing. He says, over there where that door was open, and the lights were on inside. I vaguely heard a little music going on. So I said, okay, well, I'll be back. And I started walking in that direction, thinking about, oh, my God, what am I doing? This is going to be so boring. There better be women here. I mean, this is the kind of nonsense that was going on in my mind. As I got closer to the door, this music started to get amplified. It was like, man, it was getting louder and louder and louder. And I was probably, 100 feet away from it in the parking lot, so I can barely hear it. And as I got closer, it just got louder and louder and louder. And it was some, I don't know if it was Lou Rawls or, this is 23 years ago. I don't know if it was Lou Rawls or, it was one of those people back then that really had dance music, like really could like step it up for older people. Like where old people love that stuff. Where they do the jig or the, like John used to say, yeah, we call them sock hops back in the day when we go to a dance. So as I got to the doorway, it was like decibels. You know what I mean? It's like, damn. And I look in, I go in, and it's a big room, kind of bigger, about twice his size. And I started to pan the room, looking around. And as I got towards where the sound was set up, the speakers, I see this guy dancing. There was a stage, and he was just dancing his crazy mind out. He was just getting it. He was like all over the floor, like he was dancing with his wife or something. He was like, And it was like old-fashioned, but he was a good dancer. He was like doing the twirls and all this stuff. And I noticed he had one of these on his head. And he was just having a ball. So I thought to myself, the first thing I thought, I was like, my God, man, how could he be doing that? What are people going to think about that? What an idiot. What a fool. I went to the bathroom and I came back out. He's still getting it. Never even acknowledged. I mean, he looked up and wait, but he was consumed with what he was doing. That song was good, I guess, for him. So I'm walking back out the door. And I'm going, and what struck me, listen, this is from my heart. What struck me so powerfully at that moment was, how can he let anybody on earth seeing him do that? And as I got through the door, I got about 10 feet outside. Oh my God. I had a breakdown. I was like, become overwhelmed. And like astounded, because it made perfectly clear, I had this spiritual awakening. God gave me that opportunity to see who I had become. And I just realized for the first time in my life, based on that experience, is that I have never not be concerned about what you thought of me or what you were saying about me. It dictated my life. And when you're serving people and earth and the reality down here, it's selfish and self-centered to the extreme. You're consumed with what you need, what you want, what you can get, and what you have. And the only way to get it is through you. And who do I got to be to get it from you? Even if it's just emotional support, a pat on the back. Hey, man, you're a good guy. I would have to pretend to be that person to elicit that kind of response. Even if it was as simple as a pat on the back. And I realized through that experience, I don't know who I am. I'm always concerned. It's like, God, I want to be free of this.
It was really the first time that I called out to him from the gut, from the deepest recesses of my soul, to please allow me to be free of that bondage of being somebody that I wasn't, of having to be whoever you needed me to be. And John told me years later, he said, Joe, he said, man, I told him the story. I said, because when I first got with him, I told him, my first experience of him. I tell it every time I get an opportunity to share a story, my story. And he said, Joe, you're going to have the opportunity to be completely released of that. Here's what I can tell you for certain. It's never been about you and them. It's always been about you and him. I never sought him. Not from my heart. I saw, you know, Santa Claus stuff. Please get me out of jail. And for some reason, that always worked. He adored me in spite of me. And he'd been waiting. He'd just been waiting for the time when he would just bless me with that moment of clarity where I could see that everything that happened in my life and that would happen from that point forward, everything. Would change. Where you now know that your mind is so completely broken, and you've constructed this playbook about life and people and relationships and money and success and all that. That playbook has to burn to the ground. And I didn't know there was a way. I didn't know. I had heard, but I never let it sink in. I never had the opportunity that God gave me where he would open my heart and my ears just for a second. Where I actually know that if I kept operating from that mind, I was going to die an active alcoholic. It couldn't not happen. So listen, I'm here to beg you guys. If there's anybody new or been going through this maniacal rodeo for years, in and out and out, I call it the detox retox program. Detox, retox, detox, retox. And never anything in between. No change in between. No effort to, you know, have this conversion, this transformation, this spiritual awakening as the result of this. I finally, at the time he specifies, when he believes that most of the things that have been in the way between me and him, or that could get in the way between him and I, were literally, I had walked through the fire, that there was a point where he says, you've had enough. That was after 16 years of homelessness on that street, in and out from a great family, middle class family, gave me everything. Where that clarity just said, I'm responsible. I am absolutely 100% responsible for everything that's happened in my life. I'm not a victim anymore. I'm a volunteer if I act on my mind that I know can show up that is corrupt. It's called defects of character. They don't go anywhere. They go silent as long as seeking, as long as I'm aspiring to be better than I have been, to become more of the person he created me to be, and inserting those principles by working these steps, by letting them come in and become the principle that I start operating on: honesty, faith, hope, courage, integrity, brotherly love. And you know, those are principles. The essence of each step is a principle, spiritual principle. I started to discard those selfish and self-centered principles. Me, 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 me. Take, take, take. I was such a taker. I had no idea, concept of what it would be like to be a giver. I had never given anything, but only to get something back in return. I always had a motive. I was always looking for a payoff, and I was committed to getting it from you no matter what it took. And if you didn't give it to me or you didn't acknowledge that, I'd toss you away like a piece of garbage and never talk to you again. Out of my life, you know, you're not useful to me anymore. And I, you know, and when they say that when God has that time for you, he's going to put the right champion in your life. And I met John Williams. Bigger than life to me. He's just a hometown guy. Sweet, loving, incredible student and teacher of the book. He had such a passion because it was given to him by taking on this commitment after knowing and finding out that I am destined that I harbor a death sentence within me because I have this allergy of the body that proves I can't stop once I put it in. It's a fact. And that's not the worst piece of it, that I have this obsession of the mind. Silkworth says, you know, when we go through the, when we're restless, irritable, discontent, how could you not be restless, irritable, discontent, harboring fear and regret and shame and remorse and bitterness and loneliness and shame and all? I mean, my God. I'd stop drinking, I'd go into AA. That didn't go anywhere. It didn't go anywhere when I stopped drinking. It got louder, it got ampler, it got deafening. And I had to pretend harder. I had to personify someone that didn't reflect that. And God forbid you ever see it and expose it. You became an enemy. And I would sit and wait for my retaliation and pound of flesh. If you ever said it in front of people. If you ever said it in public. Like, damn, Joe, you're a liar. Or worse. Man, you're just such a loser. It's like, I was ready to kill. How dare you? Reveal the truth of what you see in me. So anyway, I said, you know, you find out that this obsession, this lie, is what is the reason we can't stay stopped. Because of the consulting with the idiot. Silkworth says, when you succumb to the desire, he always puts, we recover from a hopeless condition of mind first and body. You know what? That's always in order. We got to recover from the mind first, and the body will heal after that. You won't get drunk. You won't have this allergy this allergy affected, aggravated, if you don't put it in. Our problem wasn't stopping. Geez, I've stopped 1,000 times. I stopped by, you know, John always said, you want to stop, slap a cop. You'll stop for about 6 months, 9 months. But with the day you come out, you're going to be thinking about where you can get a drink. Listen, when I was undrunk, the undrunk condition of an alcoholic is restlessness, irritability, and discontent to the extreme. Books and the stories, it always talks about these guys and gals having this nervous condition, like Jim and, you know, Bill and a man of 30. Like, I entered the hospital for a case of bad jitters. Like, you know, okay. I had bad jitters all the time, except when I was drunk. So if I know the only relief I'm going to get is from my truth, which is inside, that I hate myself, I hate my guts. I couldn't even look in the mirror because I hated him. I wanted him to die, I swear to God. I was so disgusted with who I'd become. Death was more attractive to me. That's a bad place. And I had it planned out. But it's all dark before the darkest before the storm. And I met with John. He said, Joe, let me just tell you something. Because he was disciplinarian. He did not mince words. He was very direct and forceful. I never wanted a sponsor like that. I wanted somebody that was like warm and fuzzy. Like, just call me, check in every day, say, hey, like, how you doing? Okay. I didn't have to talk about anything else. Just, hey, I'm doing okay. Okay, talk to me tomorrow. Nothing in between. John wasn't like that. I needed somebody that was like a drill sergeant. He said, Joe, I don't give a damn about if you like me or not. I'm not going to tell you what to do and how to do it. I'm going to give you the directions and instructions, and if you and you're to do those things. You're committing to, you don't waste my time. My time's valuable. So if I give you an assignment, you go home and you read such and such, and you reread it, and you study it, and you highlight it, and you note it. Don't call me until you can teach me about it. He was sober 35 years at the time. Now, that gave me a different perspective on the urgency I needed to take when I opened that book. He revealed very early, right up front, that this is a textbook. The preface says it. Our book has become our basic text. I heard about those things. I got them in grade school and kindergarten. They're called books of instruction. Textbooks. And we approach it like that. That's what he said. He says, this is your ticket to life. That's why we named our meeting that. This is your ticket to life, man. This isn't a ticket to get your old life back. Why do you want that? Why would you want that? Why would you want your old life back, for God's sakes? He says, this is an opportunity to become the person that God created you to be and to be reborn. To become a person you've never known, a person your family's never met, and they've never experienced this guy that God has in store for you. So that when this happens, they'll go, oh my God, he didn't do this. Nobody could have done that. Only God could, and what if he were sought? Only God could do something. They'd all say, it's a miracle, it's a miracle. It was definitely a supernatural act. An atheist that could possibly have been, you know, friends of the family or any witnessed my new way of being would have to acknowledge that God is the only one that could have done that. It's not humanly possible. He says, you're not here to do that. You're here to be recreated. Silkor says, our message must have depth and weight. You only gain depth and weight. That person knows where you've been and what you're doing, that you have a solution for this thing through their experience with you. He says, you have to have your ideals, these noble principles, these noble guidelines in life, as your anchor, as your come from, that you're acting on them because you'd work the steps, you began to do certain things, you started telling the truth, you started being a little responsive, you started showing up in your commitment, you started being your word for the very first time in your life, right? And then all of a sudden, you're getting payoffs and rewards that you weren't expecting. It's like you start to feel good about who you're becoming and not hate yourself anymore. I gotta get rolling here. So listen, I started to feel different. I told John, I said, John, let me tell you something. One of the things I've always, or most notably recently, really desired was to just, you know, I've always been a certain faith, and I've always done the rules and, you know, the traditional way of, you know, I went to church with the family and blah, blah, blah. I said the rosary, I went to confession, but I never experienced God. I never felt him. I never felt that he was my director, that he was protecting me. He's my protector. He was my instructor and my comforter and my healer. I said, I want that. I don't know how to do that. Doesn't happen by just by going to church. It's kind of like drinking, right? You can go into AA and stay stop for a little while, and if you're just not drinking and going to meetings, you can go to 15,000 meetings a day and not become sober. This isn't just about undrunkenness. This is about emotional sobriety, language of the heart, feeling your heart, letting other people experience your heart, and not worrying about what the blowback is or what they may be thinking or what their comments are under their breath. Who cares? I want him to see it. I want to let him to know that my heart is with him. You know why? Because I'm free. This thing gives you utter freedom. My attitude started changing. My desires, my appetites, money, property, prestige, fame, glory, applause, recognition, validation, job, career, success, cars. And it was never about that stuff. John says, Joe, you're not your cars or your tattoos or any of that stuff. The only thing you got to give is your heart. That's valuable. And I want him to know. Now, the only way I can do that, the only way I can express to him that this thing has changed my and I'm becoming the best I can be for him, to serve him and to glorify him, to honor him for giving me life through this. And that little saying, that one's got me to find him now. We talk about God the whole way through. The message it says in the 12th step, carry this message. What's the message? 1 through 12. Be the expression of this. And listen, language of the heart is very distinctual and noticeable. You can go into the fellowship of AA all over this country. And every meeting you walk into, you're going to have a certain percentage of people that live in the fellowship of the rooms, and the fellowship of the world and each other, and a very small percentage of those are going to have the fellowship of the Spirit and as part of this gift that we receive from working this process. God gives it to us. In the 10th step, it says, you know, that we've received this thing, and our next function is to grow with effectiveness and understanding. Effectiveness and understanding of what? Of new life, of growth in our relationship with him. So you see, if I'm going to show him and express to him my gratitude for all the things that he's given me. I mean, listen, the first thing he gave me was he removed the obsession of my mind. When I still have the obsession, I can only remember what the booze and drugs did for me. When it's removed, I can only think of what it did to me. You see the difference there? It's like there's a world apart from one another. If I'm only recalling what it did for me, I'm seeking relief. I'm still walking around with an alcoholic mind and untreated alcoholism. If I've had this obsession removed, I can only, when I think about relief or relaxing and a drink pops into my mind, I recoil like, oh my God. You know what I mean? It's kind of devastating to an individual that's lost the obsession. It's like, man, how can I think like that? It's only for a second. But all I can remember is what it did to me and to my family and all my losses and prices and all that. And I recoil like it from a hot flame. And I go, thank you. Because sometimes he wants us to remember and acknowledge him. And that's that little, you still need me, Joe. So I'm going to wrap and say, look, I could go on for a long time because my job, because I love the Lord. And guess what? He adores me in spite of me, today in spite of me. I'm not a holy roller, but I'm going to tell you something. I know one thing with absolute certainty, and I will tell it from the rooftops, that God could and will if you seek. And listen, we don't have to do it the way we always thought we did, because whatever I came in with, whether I thought it was profound or not, it wasn't sufficient to overcome alcoholism. Uh-oh. I better just chill on that for a little bit. And then work these steps, make a decision, and seek by what? Doing 4, doing 5, doing 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then incorporating 4 through 9 all the time. And then seeking him and continuing to grow. Because I love him. And every time I depend on him, it's far more freedom than me depending on me. So, man, who wouldn't want to carry that message? I was always looking for the loophole. Love you. God bless you.
Let's thank Joe one more time. And we're going to have Spencer to come up and do a quick secretary's report.
All right. Hi, my name is Spencer, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with our seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. We also have QR codes on the back of the chairs if you forgot your wallet. And I have asked Zach to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in AA identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what exactly it means to be a recovered alcoholic. Please help me welcome Zach.
My name is Zach, and I'm an alcoholic. Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered, but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body, page 23. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Thanks, Zach. 1940-style Big Book sponsorship from Forward to Second Edition, Alcoholics Anonymous, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried. 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Is anyone needing a sponsor? Oh, we got one in the back. We got some more. All right. And if you're too shy to raise your hand, there's a piano in the back. You can stand by conveniently, and somebody will come and find and help you out. Can the recovered alcoholics please raise their hand? All right. If your hand's not raised, we suggest you hang out with those who were. All right, and now it's time for a screen announcement. Intergroup is where you can buy AA-related literature and medallions. Intergroup is also responsible for creating our where and when and scheduling the AA hotline. Stop by and visit them. BCIC, Broward County Institutions Committee, is responsible for bringing meetings into places where people like us can't get out to an AA meeting, such as jails, detoxes, and rehabs. They meet monthly to organize meetings at the 12 Step House. Do we have any members of BCIC here tonight? All right, cool. If not, you can go back and talk to Mike Chase. He'll tell you everything you need to know. And then we do have some volunteer opportunities. Looks like Intergroup's having a planning meeting for their picnic Sunday, September 22nd at 2 p.m. at the 12 Step House. And then next week, come back for week one of Pat R. We have him until Halloween night, so it should be a spooky series. And, of course, we have our Monday night Big Book study. This is, hold on now. Of course, we have our Hungriest Big Book, Big Book Study, yeah. Where the Big Book comes live, join us at 6:30, for fellowship, or 6:45 according to that. And 7:15, the meeting stops, starts promptly. We're in the doctor's opinion. So if you want to hear more about what Joe was talking about, what that problem of the obsession of the mind is, maybe the allergy of the body, it's a great place to find out. And we do have CDs, mugs, large print big books, little red books, big book dictionaries for sale. We meet every Thursday promptly at 7:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. See you next week.
Podcasts are online at alcoholicsandgod.org. If you want to thank Joe, please line up down the center aisle, and we're going to close with the Lord's Prayer seated. If you don't know it, it's going to be up on the screen, hopefully.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
is heavy, our shoulders thirsty, bodies aching. I am desperately in need of restoration.
blessed sun comes shining through. But when you crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby. And I hope
out in the dark, I'm gonna let it shine. Out in the dark, I'm gonna let it shine. Out in the dark, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, 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 let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, 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 let it shine.
All right, Michael Chase, here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go. Fog is lifted. See the light, count my blessings when I go to sleep at night, and I dream now. Fear has left me and I'm standing tall. A pile of bricks now lies where once there stood a wall that I hid behind. For all this time, sometimes it takes a burning bush or a great white light to set you right. Well, my eyes don't cry now, and I'm out to dry. Pity party's over, the guest of honor has arrived, and he's on my side. For the first time in my life, are green now, growing vines. They twist and turn each way. Flowers blooming all the time outside my door. But never before I had to change everything to realize that today is the best day of my life. This broken man had traveled far and wide, drew the great divide through his own heart, yeah. Well, I have a life today when it give away and it's just about to start. I'm plugging my guitar and I play my songs and people sing along and stomp their feet and raise their arms. And here in this moment that we share, nothing could come in. Lessons when I go to sleep at night, and I dream now. Yeah, I dream now, and everything's all right. Oh man, going on 10 years old that song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.
This one, don't you? My soul.
Shot.